copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
What we're going to be doing is looking at this phenomenon we call the sexual revolution and try to understand its impact on us as Christians and how we should be beginning to shape our response. So, what is the sexual revolution and how did it come about? Well, let me answer that question by telling you a story. Okay? And the story begins back in the 50s, about the mid-50s, late-50s, and this little boy brought up in a Christian home, and he asks his grandmother, when he's aged about 9, what a word he's heard means on the radio. And he detects that it may cause her a little embarrassment. So he says, "Granny, what does the word pregnant mean?" And you know what she says? His Christian granny in this Christian home to this Christian little boy, she thinks and she says, "I don't know. I don't know what the word pregnant means." He's 9 years old and I'm that little boy and I knew very well that she did know. And I had some other questions to ask her. But that was a small introduction to the climate of shame and fear and ignorance that shrouds this whole area of being made sexual as human beings within our Christian culture. And my experience unfolded as I entered into puberty with a very awkward talk from my mother on the way back from the bus stop to the home, and I came away from that talk with the impression that men and women did something that was dirty together, and basically I wasn't to do it. And then when I was 14, my father left a book in my bedroom which told me there were one or two things I definitely should not be doing. And so fear and prejudice and shame and ignorance, this is a hallmark of the experience of so many Christians. And I hope this was in the late 1950s, things are so much better today. But I tell you, friends, as I talk to younger Christians today, very often they're not that much better. And how many of us here can honestly say it was our Christian home or our church was the place where we learned under God about the goodness under God of our erotic longings? The Catholic theologian Christopher West says, if teaching about sex in our churches were a food, most of us have been brought up on the starvation diet. Now, so the story unfolds. Let's leave this little boy or a little girl, your grandson, your daughter, maybe even you. Let's leave them standing there in their shame and cross the Atlantic where there's an older boy. He's grown up. I think he's in his late 20s now, maybe early 30s. He's about to launch the world's first ever mass market girly magazine. And what is it called?
Playboy.
And his name is? Hugh Hefner. And Hugh Hefner, in a recent interview before he died, looking back on that launch of the magazine so many decades ago, said one of his motivations for doing that was a reaction to the, quote, hurt and hypocrisy of his Methodist religious upbringing. And you can see what he was saying. Hugh Hefner said, "We've had enough of the starvation diet. From now on, it's going to be fast food. Fast food." Now you see this little chap here, if he's faced with a choice between a starvation diet and a fast food diet, what do you think he's going to choose? And so it was activists like Hefner who launched and then sustained and helped push forward a huge social and cultural revolution that we've come to call the sexual revolution. And it was driven by an overarching narrative of freedom, freedom from starvation. And as this cultural revolution began to unfold, we see many different areas that we freed ourselves from or thought we were freeing ourselves from. And here we have in England and Wales the raw number of divorces, and you can see it, 1962, they'd actually just been declared, 1962, as the revolution gets going, the numbers of divorces rocket sixfold as we free ourselves, we thought at the time, from the oppressions of patriarchy and of unhappy, stultifying relationships. And then as the revolution unfolds further, we see that the number of marriages, and this is just the raw number, the absolute numbers of marriages, the population's going up over this period, the numbers of people getting married goes into a sharp and prolonged decline. In fact, that decline continues, especially among the poorest, not the richest, the poorest is where it's felt most. And in England and Wales, 2013, the most recent set of ONS, Office of National Statistics data, shows that the number of people getting married has never been lower. So marriage is in recession. As we freed ourselves, it was said, from being bounced into premature relationships that we'd not trialed and tested. Well, enough of that. We free ourselves from that straitjacketing of religion, and we're free. And then we discover with the introduction of gay marriage in many European countries, we freed ourselves from authorities who told us what marriage is, and who took it upon themselves to be the guardians of the gateways to marriages, who is included and who is excluded. Well, we freed ourselves from that, and we decide who enters marriage and who lays claim to the goods of marriage. If it's good enough for heterosexuals, why isn't it good enough for same-sex attracted people, we said. And then finally we free ourselves from nature herself, from the straitjacket of biology as defining our sex, and from stereotypes and from all of the other traditions that are imposed on the human spirit and bind it. Well, no, freedom is the defining narrative of this revolution. And in just a few decades, friends, the reality we have to embrace here together is that centuries-old convictions about sex and marriage in just a few decades have effectively collapsed, Christian convictions. And the other reality we have to face is that I know this differs across Europe, so Poland will be very different from England. Hungary perhaps very different from the Netherlands, but nevertheless this revolution is everywhere, and the majority of people, certainly in my country and many younger people even in the more conservative countries, look on this revolution and look on its jailbreak from the past, and they either don't care or they think good riddance to the past. I don't know about you, when I think about this revolution, I think, well, what is the secret of its power? How did it happen? How did it gain a foothold and then become a stronghold in the human heart to this degree? I don't know whether you've heard of Joseph Nye, the political theorist. He talked about two kinds of power. Anyone any idea? Hard power, soft power. Hard power, you send in the troops. It's exerting force through coercion. It's changing things through coercion. Soft power, on the other hand, is the ability to get what you want using attraction. Now, the activists of the sexual revolution They know how to deploy hard power. But because that hurts for Christians very often, we've focused on that and neglected what I'd like to suggest is the real secret of its power, its strength, which is its soft power, its ability to be attractive to the human spirit, to so involve us in its story that we want it to be true. I think there are probably three kinds of soft power we need to pay attention to. The power of ideas, the power of ideals, that is having a moral vision that you set before people, and the power of story. Should we take each one of these in turn? The power of ideas. Martin Luther said, if you want to change the world, pick up a pen and write ideas. And we sit here because of his ideas. And this revolution had what seemed to be new ideas about one of the biggest questions we ever ask as human beings, and that is, who am I? Question of identity. And where do I, as I stand before an empty universe, who will give me the answer to that question? Who am I? And this revolution comes along and it provides an answer. And it says, you just need to look inside yourself for the answer. You search deep within for your true self, your authentic self. And then you live, you express the truth that you find there about yourself. And live truthfully, authentically with that. The technical term, it was coined by a sociologist called Robert Bella in the 1950s. This idea is expressive individualism. Expressive individualism, Bella said, grows out of the American dream. The American dream, as he looked at American history, it's about self-reliance. It's a kind of individualism that was, the term individualism was coined by the French political theorist and historian Alexis de Tocqueville. And Tocqueville noticed that the American dream led to a certain kind of rugged individualism. You rely on yourself. And Bella said the early forms of individualism were what he called utilitarian individualism. That is, you relied on yourself to make something of the world and of your life and of your family and of your kids. You didn't wait for other people to come and sort these things out. You took on the responsibility for this and you did it yourself. It's the American kind of dream, and you can do it, you see. That's utilitarian individualism. But, says Bella, with the rise of the new psychologies of the 20th century and therapy culture, a different kind of individualism grew out of utilitarian individualism, and he called it expressive individualism. What's expressive individualism? It's relying on yourself not to make something of the world, but to make something of yourself, me. Self-fulfillment becomes the defining goal of my life, the main road of my destiny, to fulfill myself, to express the truth about myself, you see. And friends, it's everywhere around us, isn't it? Expressive individualism. It's in rom-coms and sitcoms. It makes us laugh. It makes us cry. It's the stories of just be yourself. All around us. And you can see its power, because it presents before us a picture of the unencumbered self, self set free, thrown off the shackles, the hypocrisy and the fear and the ignorance, and you just be the person that you are, the unencumbered self, freed from tradition and religion and people like you out there, with your petty rules and straitjackets that you impose on the little people that you push out to the edges who don't fit your script. Well, says this revolution, those days are over. These people that you've forced out are going to be set free. And what are they going to be set free? Not what I say they are, but who they say they are. And that narrative is everywhere around us. Expressive individualism. But then the power of ideals, of moral vision, because this revolution comes, these ideas are freighted with the notion of virtue. That relying on yourself to be yourself, to find yourself, isn't just the right thing to do in intellectual terms, philosophical terms, it's the right thing to do in moral terms. I mean, is there anybody here who's against being honest and true and authentic? Or are we all for hypocrisy here, you see? And I think this, the putting forward of a moral vision, is what caught Christians off guard more than anything else in this revolution. Because you see, if you talk about morality, well, that's our territory, isn't it? I mean, where's the moral high ground round here? We make for it. That's us. And we're used, because we've been in the mainstream of culture for so many centuries, we're used to calling out immorality wherever we see it. So we can call out adultery and pornography and sleeping around, because that's our natural territory. It breaks our rules. And when the revolution came along, we thought it would be business as usual. But far from unveiling a Dantean nightmare of debauchery on the face of it, this revolution cast a moral vision of just being real, honest, sincere, and looking out for the little people who don't fit. And it cast you as the immoral, the bigots, the Pharisees, the people who don't like the ones who don't fit, and you drive them out, and you heap your hatred on them. Look, take these characters from a... Oh, by the way, and this virtue, this picture of freedom that sets before us, actually is a kind of virtue in the Aristotelian sense of that word. It leads to flourishing. It's a way of being in the world, being true to yourself, that if followed leads to a freedom of the spirit and a completion of the self, a flourishing of the self. That is, the self achieves its full potential and a fairness for the self and for other selves. Take the individuals you may see in a gay pride march, okay? Now, where does this fit with this? Take pictures of this, you see. Now, presented with pictures of these pride marches parade down the main roads of most of our cities. They go past churches where the doors are usually locked and bolted, and double bolted on the inside. And faced with pictures of sexual fluidity like this, we are kind of used as Christians to wrinkle our noses. Our default response is to talk about AIDS or sexually transmitted diseases and breakdown of society. And what we need to understand is, to many people out there, many not in your... in perhaps more Eastern European cultures, not many older people, but believe me, many younger people, these images are beginning to present pictures of moral purpose. The moral purpose of being real. These people are saying, you continue with your hypocrisy. Have you seen the rates of sexual abuse in churches? And in the Catholic Church, and in Protestant churches, that you hid behind and covered up, and the little people under the crushing weight of your rules that can't be themselves and have to pretend, and all the hypocrisy that breeds. Well, look, you carry on in your little world if you want, but this is who we are. And in case you didn't notice, it's called pride. And we're flourishing, we're free. And we're happy. Now, you take some great new ideas of individuality and autonomy, and you stir them together with great stories of the little people having the courage to stand up and march through the streets past your church doors. And you put them together into lots of little stories and bigger stories, and you've got a revolution on your hand, because this is a revolution with an overarching story of how we broke free, the power of narrative. And we are living now in this, we swim in it, we breathe this story, it's all around us. And it's told and retold over and over again. Your children are brought up on it in, what film is this? What's the film? Frozen. Everybody knows this. I've spoken to a few youth leaders' conferences, and I say, how many people have seen Frozen? Everybody's hand goes up in England. And you remember this character, this is her moment of breaking free. She's going to, what's the song she's singing? Let It Go. And of course, we're now part of the narrative, because she does need to break through. She does need to break free in many ways of the way she's been treated. She's going to let it go. But the problem is, she doesn't know where she's going to let it go, because there are no right, no wrong, no rules for me, you see. I follow my inner self. This is more than a recognition or an acceptance of the self. This is an enthronement of the self. And your kids are brought up on this narrative that not only wins their minds, but more importantly, it wins their hearts, because it makes them want it to be true. And it's everywhere around us. It comes down your earphones. Madonna, I am my own experiment. I am my own work of art. And how did we traditionalist Christians, Bible Christians, how did we respond to great stories like that? Well, with silence. We kind of hope it'll go away. Heads down. Nobody wants to speak about it. Or we issue lists and facts. But as the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor says, it's no use trying to respond to a great story with facts. You've got to tell a different story. And so back to this little chap here, he's still here. He gets a bit bored by now, actually, because he's heard this talk before. But he's still here. Your son, your daughter, you, or somebody you know, in your church. And as they feel this, and as they swim in this story, he's asking, I think I know what we're against. I've got that. I've been to the pornography seminar. And I think I get that as Christians, we're against loads of stuff to do with sex. But what he wants to know is, what are we for? What are we for? And the people, the attractive role models he wishes would say something positive, are keeping quiet. And some of the people he wished kind of wouldn't say anything are sometimes going out there, and he thinks they look a bit mean. And he thinks they don't get it, and that they're not listening. And we have to face the scale of this revolution, that its power isn't just hard power to win the war, it's soft power to win our hearts and the hearts of our children. And that when I give this talk, I often ask, as we think about this story, how are you all feeling now? And I'll to keep moving at the moment, I'll just, a lot, hopeless, discouraged, overwhelmed, One pastor put his hand up and he said, "I'll tell you how I'm feeling." He said, I'm feeling, I hope what's coming next is good. Because I'm almost worried that I think what you've just said in my heart. But my head tells me that's not true, but I don't know what to say to it. And we may have all kinds of levels of understanding of what's going on, but the young people in our churches don't. That's our problem. And they're crying out to us as Christian leaders to help them see what it's for. And the reason we're not doing, because we don't know what it's for. We haven't got a positive story that makes us smile, that makes us feel we have something, a gift for the world that will change the world. And so we've all got work to do here. I'll come back in a minute, okay? So I just want to know three last things about, then I'll break for one or two questions. But three last things about the power of story here, okay? First of all, this narrative power, I hope you notice what I've just said, the simplicity of this story. Of course, if you want to try and understand the sexual revolution, it is far more complicated than what I've just said. I mean, it isn't all due to Hugh Hefner and people. It's far more. If you're an economist here, you're saying, no, it was the post-war boom in prosperity that liberated women into the marketplace, gave them an independence they'd never had before, financial independence, and so divorces went up. Or it put money into people's pockets, greater social mobility that we'd never known before, people moved around, and it put strains on relationships. Well, that's the economist, and there's something in that, isn't there? But then if you're a public health physician here, a doctor, you would say, well, of course, the economic analysis is interesting and has something to say, but I'll give you three words that explain the sexual revolution. The first word is the. Give me the next word, the. Contraceptive. Pill, okay? The pill. Because the pill comes in, and at a stroke, you uncouple sex from its consequences. And so, whew, the revolution. If you're a philosopher here, interested in the history of ideas, you'd say this didn't all start with Hugh Hefner. We've been revisiting the notion of the inner light for centuries. The last time was in the mid-19th century with the Romanticists, the New Romantics, Rousseau and Delacroix and artists like that who talked about the deep interior and the liberation of the inner, raw, true self. Or you could take it back to Gnosticism with its hatred of the body and its search for the inner light, you see. So, and if you're into queer theory here, you say, but we've had the rise of queer theory. And if you follow Jordan Peterson, you say, but we haven't even mentioned cultural Marxism here and the way in which Marxism will seek any kind of underdog analysis as a means of disrupting the status quo of social order. And so, forget the old capitalist the old Marxist paradigm of capitalist and kind of worker exploited. This is a new paradigm of oppressor and oppressed. And wherever the oppressed, notably LGBT groups, are, they need to be liberated from that oppression, a kind of way of disrupting society, cultural. So we could have seminar after seminar after seminar to analyze the different tributaries to this river that we call the sexual revolution. But here's my point. It's the simplicity of the story I've just told you which explains its power. The people out there, particularly over the Western Europe, but it's in your own young people's hearts through social media and media in general. People out there, they don't know about queer theory and Delacroix and Rousseau and cultural Marxism. They don't know about that so much, but what they do know is you've just got to be yourself. They do know about expressive individualism because it's everywhere around us. So do you notice the power of simplicity that drives this narrative? And it's simple narrative structure. How does the story go? It starts with a context, you get a problem arises, a saviour comes to rescue, and everybody lives happily ever after. It's the same simple narrative structure. Simplicity. And we have facts and sheets and long doctrines. And when the bishops of the Church of England eventually feel they have to say something about marriage, what they issue is a 10-page document that reads more like the terms and conditions of a software upgrade than a manifesto for human flourishing, you see? It doesn't appeal to the heart. It doesn't show you its truth. It doesn't help you to feel its truth as well as tell you its truth, its simplicity. Then there's its ability to evoke empathy in its hearers, and I've touched on that. Then finally, this story's cultural embodiment. In other words, what I mean by that, it's already changing our habits of life culturally to reflect, to teach us its own truth. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, let me give you an example. In most every other hotel I go in, except this hotel, because they knew I was going to give this illustration, if you go into the bathroom, by the sink, there's a little cardboard notice. And what does that say? This little notice in hotels, by the sink.
The towels.
Pick up your towels off the floor. Okay. Now, imagine you're a Martian, landed in a hotel, and you see this cultural artifact here, because that's kind of what it is, and the last one I saw, the last hotel I was on, it said, "Help us to save the planet." Okay? So he sees it, "Help us save the planet," the Martian. So he thinks this is really serious. So he looks, how do I help to save the planet? And it says, pick up your towel off the floor. And he asks you to explain to him what this is about. And you say, well, it's a long story. And then you tell him the story. And you say, we used to think we could just throw all our stuff in the bin and put it in brown bags after our lunch, and then we just leave it and someone will pick it up, and then it goes somewhere. And we never thought it went in landfill sites and the plastic ends up in the oceans and that we destroy the world that God gives us. We kind of thought we could just carry on forever like that, pumping out carbon dioxide. And now we're beginning to realize that if we do that, we will destroy ourselves. So we're all trying to pull together to make a difference. And all right-thinking people more or less sign up, which is why the hotels have it. Saves them money as well, but hey. Now, then we go out with our Martian into Bristol, where I live, into the main street, and we come across a bank. And he says, what's that? And you say, it's a bank. And what's a bank for? Well, that's for putting your money in, and they look after it safely, usually, hopefully. And they will lend you money. And you can go in there, and you can ask to open an account. And he says, goodness, so what does this notice here? What does that mean? And this is a big, big notice in the window. And it says, he said yes. He said yes. These are all around the high streets, in banks, in this bank in England. Main, one of the big four. He said yes. So the Martian says, well, wow, he's really happy. He's got a bank account opened. You know, that's amazing. It must be a big thing if the bank manager says yes, you can have a bank account, presumably. And you say, well, no, actually, it's not about that. So what's this about? What is it about? Please tell me. Gay marriage. You know that. You see, this is a cultural artifact that is reflecting back into culture what all right-thinking people here have pretty much signed up to. Now, once an idea has entered a culture at that level where it recruits the cultural artifact to serve its cause. If you follow the work of Peter Berger, the fine sociologist, he would say you are generating powerful plausibility structures in society. That is, your social way of life is supporting that idea very powerfully. And all the role models will fall in behind it. And most people, the way they talk about it will be as if, well, most right people, they won't ask you whether you believe it. They'll assume you do, because it's part of the cultural settlement for the time being. And notice how the sexual revolution has recruited our culture at that revolution. So do you see the power of its story? And this is the revolution we're in. And the challenge to us is, how do we respond? How do we get started? And the reason I've spent this time with a bit of cultural analysis is, friends, it's no use diving in with the answers if we don't understand the question. And we have to understand the questions here that we're being faced, because we are losing Christians. Again, the western fringes of Europe, and I know in the east as well, in areas, to the sexual revolution. And so how do we respond? Okay. Let's then think about how we engage with this culture that's all around us. And I think when we're engaged with a culture, you and a story, you can fight it, you can get the lawyers out, and you can combat that culture and call out its weaknesses and expose its problems and really fight it. And there are elements in that I think personally is right. We do have to be ready to fight in key areas, especially for justice, for the little people, ourselves. But you can also hide from it, become like the Amish, and batten down and pretend it's not happening. You can give in to it and absorb it and reconcile with it. Or another way is you can enter its story. You can enter into its narrative at the point at which it invites you. So, where's an example of that? Well, let's think of Paul in Acts 17. On Acts 17, if you remember, we read in the morning that Paul walks around Mars Hill and he is, quote, deeply disturbed by what he sees. He is, quote, deeply disturbed, unquote. He's churned up. He's troubled. He's upset emotionally by what he sees as the evil and the oppression of idolatry. And you can almost hear him writing Romans 1 in his head. They exchanged the truth about God for a lie, so they worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator. And he saw this as a subversion of the glory of God, as humans made in his image stoop before snakes and before half-human, half-beast, and prostrate themselves before these things, and he's broken-hearted. So, very shortly, he gets his chance to engage with this culture of idolatry. And they put him up at the Areopagus, and what does he do? Does he call them out? Go to Romans 1, God has given you over to a depraved mind. This is his opening sentence. Idolaters. I mean, it's very interesting. You all know what he says. He says, people of Athens, I see that you are very religious. It's really interesting, you see. I see that you are very religious. I see you want something. I sense that you have spiritual longings. So before I give you my answer, I want to connect with your question. And I want to say, we're all in the same territory. We all both stand on the same ground. I'm like you. I have spiritual longings. We're all part of this same story that begins with our spiritual longings. So he connects with the question before he piles in with the answer. And I'd just like to suggest gently to you that that is a model for how we can begin to connect with this revolution, because you can analyze it at the level of cultural Marxism. But you're going to have your grandson or your daughter saying, "Look, I'm gay, Dad and Mum." And it's no use talking about cultural Marxism now, because they've got this big issue. And you're going to have to deal with a human being. And whenever I see Jesus dealing with human beings, he creates room to recognize what their hearts want before he leads them as their shepherd to a very different place, or confronts them with what their heart wants. But he does create that space. Zacchaeus, I'm coming to your house for tea. I want to come and walk alongside you. I want to enter into your home, into your story. What's going on? Can we do the same? Can we just create a bit of space to listen to people a little more? To sense what they want in all of this? Because what I want to suggest is that that puts us on the same ground. Actually, that allows us to begin to tell our story, because our story converges with theirs at exactly the same point. The big question, who am I? So people of Athens, I see that you're obsessed with identity today, to quote the New York Times article 2015. We are obsessed with identity. People of Athens, I see that you're obsessed with identity and who we are, and that's my story too. And like you, I look within and I want to be real about what I found. So can I begin to share my story with you about what I found? Because we're both in the same place. We're both asking questions. And it's about tone. It's about connection. And I want to suggest four words that would help us adjust our posture with this revolution. Instead of kind of like this, or frightened or overwhelmed, our posture can be a little more open-handed. And there are four words I want to suggest might help us. Sorry, thank you, please, and never. Never. Okay? Sorry. Look, we're sorry we let you down. We promised life abundant, and yet this big area of our lives, sex, we said nothing. And we covered it with a shame and a fear. And we have brought our kids up very often in that. And we're sorry that when we should have said what we believe, we were fearful and frightened. And we're sorry because some of us have been bigoted. And some of us have amplified your sins whilst neglecting our own. So we're focused on the gays and the transgender out there. Lots of seminars on that. But we've kind of gone easy on the divorce in here. And we don't talk much about divorce because, well, there's quite a few divorced people, and it upsets them, so we don't talk about that. But we'd like to talk about the gay issue. That's one. And the scriptures are very clear about the gay issue, but hey, with divorce it all gets less clear, does it? I'm not. You know, there's a conversation to be had, but we need to go back. It's driven me back, my own interest in this area, to look at what Jesus says and to say, I follow him. In the end, I must obey what Jesus says. So we're sorry where we've been hypocrites, actually. And we're sorry that we've always been keener on what we're against rather than what we're for. And where some of us have been bigoted. Look, friends, I don't feel bigoted at all. And not at all. But if a gay person shows me an email that they've had from someone, and I read it, and I say, the person who wrote you that, that's a Christian, wrote you that? I want to say I'm sorry for that, because it's a violation of the way of Christ. Because it violated you as a person, diminished you, and showed you no love. And I'm sorry that those people do that. And thank you. Thank you for not letting us brush this under the carpet. We'd have liked to. Gosh, that's our default, back under the carpet. Thank you for keeping coming to us. Thank you for calling out our hypocrisy. And thank you for driving us back to our Bibles to say, what do we really believe? Because we've got to start winning our young people's hearts all over again, and our own. So thank you. And then please, you know, in 1 Peter 3:15, what does Peter say? He says, always be ready to give a reason for the hope that lies within you. Sadly for us, we can't give the reason, the answer we want to give when someone asks that question. So someone says, so what do you think about gay marriage? You say, oh, I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about Jesus. And they say, well, no, that in a minute. I want to ask you about gay marriage, because I think you Christians, I can understand why adultery is wrong, and I understand why murder is wrong, but I don't understand why you'd want to drive down people who don't fit. Help me understand that. You say, no, I want to speak about penal substitutionary atonement, the gospel, you see. They say, no, I want to talk about this because I don't want to hear about your Saviour until I understand a bit more about his followers. You can't keep ducking. You have to be ready to give a reason for the hope, the whole hope that lies within you. Then Peter says, well, and he goes on, do you notice the next two words? But do so with respect and graciousness. That's what should be our hallmark. So please is respectful. So please, can we do a couple of things? We want to do two things. And I'm going to finish with the first, all right? Having owned up some of our failed promises, can we look at some of yours? Please, can we get beyond the slogans to look at the truth of things, of your promises? Just do it respectfully, but insist on beginning to look at the truth. And what you've just done in saying please, I don't see you have to say please and sorry. It's just an attitude of heart, you see. People will smell it about you. They sniff. They feel that you're not out there. What it's the Christ-like thing to do, I suggest. Before you remove, specks out of other people, just keep a look on our own churches first. I think it's Christ-like. But it's also the smart thing to do. Because it subverts the narrative. The narrative is you don't say sorry. All you're interested in is getting out your rules and putting them on people. You're not self-aware. You don't acknowledge what your churches do. That's the narrative, you see. You subvert that. You say, look, I just want to say, we got some stuff wrong here. And I want to say, you've taught us one or two things. It's smart because it subverts the narrative and it gets you a hearing, potentially. But then please, respectfully, can we look at the truth? Can we get to the keep insisting on the truth of things together? If they'll give you that hearing. You promised freedom. That's expressive individualism. Is it delivering the freedoms? I mean, what about headlines like this from last week's Guardian? Young Britons have never been unhappier, research suggests. We've had 5 decades of expressive individualism. There's no evidence that this slogan is producing human flourishing. I'm not saying that it's making us unhappy. I'm too careful a scientist to say that. But what I can say is that it's not preventing this ongoing struggle with who we are that we all feel so painfully. The self-esteem movement's been trying to get us to assert our own worth for 5 decades. When psychologists got around to measuring that in a trial, and this is a trial if we had time I could talk about, but I haven't, but when they get around to testing these self-boosting statements, I'm special, I attract people to myself. I'm worthy. I'm strong. You see, does that work? What this randomized trial found was that people who started the study with low self-worth, at the end, after telling themselves for 6 months that they were strong, they felt worse, not better. Why? Because it's just your own propaganda. And friends, if the self has no power to assert its own worth, on what basis do we peddle the snake oil that we can assert our own meaning? Expressive individualism, as the words of Matthew Crawford, popular philosopher, beautiful book, The World Beyond Your Head. As Matthew Crawford says, we have consigning a generation to an endless treadmill of self-making that is groundless. And we're inviting a self that says, I'm nowhere, to go somewhere, but actually to go anywhere, from nowhere to anywhere. This isn't good news for freedom. Snake oil. Expressive individualism is a defunct doctrine that doesn't... Now, we all know the good that it appeals to, which is simply be authentic, be real. That's its hook, because it says you need to be real about yourself. But then again, we share that with the revolution, don't we? Because the gospel says, yeah, you start with being real about yourself. You start by being really real about yourself. So we share that. So we share its aim to be authentic, but we do not share its solution to somehow celebrate what we find. No, we have a higher understanding of what it means to be a human being. So freedom? No, I don't think so. What about flourishing? Flourishing, that's your true potential? Well, at least you'd expect this in sexuality, wouldn't you? In sex, people having more sex. These are the data, and I'm running on now. 1990, 2000, 2010. In England and Wales, the median frequency of having sex in the last 4 weeks, that's the average number of times people have sexual relations in the last 4 weeks, aged 16 to 44. These are the best data available. They're all problematic, but these are the best. In 1990, same for men and women, it was 5 times. In 2000, it's 4 times. In 2010, it's 3 times. Now, a statistician will tell you that you never extrapolate a graph, but if you did, no one will be having any sex at all by the year 2040. So why is it? Another headline in the Times, the millennial generation having less sex than ever. There are all kinds of reasons, but this is a revolution that promises more and delivers less, which reminds us of idols. They always do that. They offer more and more, but deliver less and less until they have everything. You have nothing. Really? Flourishing? Our hearts were drawn into this narrative. Well, let's pull them back out, because this is snake oil. This isn't flourishing.
This is snake
oil. Snake oil. Sorry, it's a term... Yes, sorry. Ah, bless you. Yes, thanks for raising that. Snake oil. It's just a term that's used for, American quacks used to go around selling cures for everything, and people would buy it, and you call it, he's selling snake oil. It doesn't work, you know, it's just stuff that stacks up in piles, and it's the cure of, you know. Fairness. Well, this revolution, we need to think about fairness on a much bigger canvas than my rights. What about our duties? What about our duties toward the weakest of all, which are our children? Could this be a revolution that's delivered a kind of fairness for some adults, but visited unfairness and injustice on countless numbers of children? Now, we haven't got time right now to go into the toll that this revolution's taken. But when we talk about fairness, friends, we need to think about them. Okay? Thank you so much, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.